Welcome to the Live Up podcast, where we watch the movies from our youth to see if they live up. Quick note on how this will go. We will review, discuss, and score the movie in question to see if it lives up to us now as adults and whether it would live up to kids today. I'm Jess Latterman.
Hey, listeners. We forgot to hit record, so we're recording this episode again, which is apt when you hear what we're reviewing.
Oh, my God.
Jess is busy freaking out, but we should probably start the episode.
We probably should.
6 a.m. Get out the study and chair.
I don't even know where to begin.
I'm laughing because this is the perfect movie to do this to.
I'm not even going to cut this part, listeners. I forgot to hit record.
All right. I'm Amanda Treat. On today's episode, for the second time, it's 1993.
Groundhog Day!
Again!
Oh, my God.
Jess, honestly, what if you got stuck in a podcast recording loop and you just had to record that intro you do over and over and over and over?
I know. And the what listeners don't know is that I am in that loop most of the time because I screw it up so many times. But I just spare you, the listeners. I only give you the best take. Oh, now we're going to be punchy since we've recorded this already. Yeah, it's Groundhog Day.
Jess, what's your history with Groundhog Day and recording podcasts?
Oh, well, you know, I did just tell you this, but I'm going to tell you it again, Amanda. So I saw this movie a lot on TV. I think that I didn't see it from start to finish all the time. So we would just come in and watch it whenever, however it was on. So I saw it enough that everything was familiar to me. I've seen it 100 times, but I think I've seen it from start to finish very few times.
It's like I've heard that before, but still.
Does
really
it sound familiar? Yeah. Well, what about you, Amanda?
I definitely saw this movie in the theater and probably rented it a few times, although I can't recall if this was a Groundhog's Day seasonal renting or if we just rented it at random because we liked it when we were kids. I also will tell you a story about my French colleague. Jess is laughing. She just heard this.
Please tell me the story again, Amanda. How does Bill Murray do it?
I have a few French colleagues, and last year had lightly said to someone on February 2nd, official Groundhog's Day, that, oh, hey, it's Groundhog's Day in the U.S. And one of them said, oh, do you need to take a vacation day? And it's like, no, not really a holiday, but here's what the holiday is. And then proceeded to describe a bunch of men dressed in top hats and tuxedos on the television holding a giant rodent up in the air and talking to it and then telling us whether it's winter or spring. And my French supervisor at the time just deadpan looked at me and said, I do not think this is a thing.
It's such a weird thing to explain.
It weirds me out that there's like this group of men who are dressed in tops and tails, like so fancy, literally holding a rodent in the air.
So weird.
Like it just, the absurdity of how that looks. So yeah, that doesn't translate well to other countries, nor should it.
Yeah, I think this is, it's very on brand for America, to be honest.
Let's have fun with our rodents in the beginning of February.
But make it rodents, but make it black tie.
Make it, it's a black tie rodent affair. It is. Yes. Jess, do you want to give another summary of Groundhog Day? I know it feels like it does,
but I'm going to do it again. So Groundhog Day is basically a stream of consciousness life commentary by Bill Murray. It's irreverent, it's ridiculous, it's charming all at once. And if you watch this movie enough, Groundhog Day in and of itself is now a descriptor for being stuck in a loop. If someone says, oh, it's like Groundhog Day, you know that that means some sort of version of deja vu. Perhaps not the younger listeners, maybe, not so much.
You watched this with your kids?
I did watch this with my kids, and I had to explain this concept to them.
You were hinting at they may not understand what's going on.
My son didn't really quite understand the concept. It took him about 2/3 of the movie to finally grasp that he was living the same day over and over again. He's like, wait, I just saw this part. Did he die? He was very confused. But yeah, but now seeing it as an adult for the first time in a long time from start to finish, it is like Bill Murray's commentary on life, essentially.
So before we dive in on the characters in our review, just a little background on this movie. It's written by Danny Rubin and then co-written by Harold Ramey. But the original idea for it came from Danny Rubin reading Interview with a Vampire by Anne Rice. And he was thinking about, like, what if you were doomed to live for eternity. What would you be feeling? When would you stop caring about anything you were doing to your body or to other people? You know, go into effort mode immediately. Like, what's the progression there? And it wasn't a comedy. It was a very dark, philosophical, what if you were living for eternity? Harold Ramey came in and helped write the next draft of this, and it became a comedy because we know Harold Ramey. He's from Ghostbusters. Very, you know, him and Bill Murray are the comedic duo from that era. And they rewrote the script. There was a little bit of a battle, like, is this about philosophy or do we want to just be really funny with the whole thing? And they kind of landed in a balanced place, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. Just a really cool concept, I think, for our generation, which then got repeated in other forms like The Day After Tomorrow or Russian Doll. The Stuck in a Loop has come up in other forms now. One cool thing about making this movie, if you think about it, and this is just, you know, film nerd stuff, but they had to really think hard about continuity because any scene that's shot outside is supposed to be February 2nd. The weather's supposed to be bleak. So you can't have a rainstorm in the middle of a scene that we previously saw, you know, it was sunny. Or like if there's clouds in the sky, but there's not, and you're doing the same moment of his day over and over, you have to figure out how to film that so it looks exactly the same every time. Every time he rounds the corner and runs into Ned, it's got to look exactly the same out. So they had to shoot it all on the same day, like all those scenes completely out of order, but on the same day. Would have been kind of a logistical challenge, but I think that's super cool.
It has to look like it's the same time of day. So if you're shooting at 10 a.m. and still shooting at 3 p.m., like it's like it can't look like it's approaching dusk. It has to look like it's the same time. Yeah.
Yeah. So huge constraints there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting.
He must have stepped in that puddle so many times within like an hour. We like to talk about our movies character by character rather than chronologically. And boy, do we have a big character to start with here. It's Bill Murray playing Phil Connors. Jess, what are your thoughts on Phil, the weatherman?
Yeah. So this Bill Murray, this is his second appearance on this podcast. So we reviewed Ghostbusters. And I think we noted in that episode, Amanda noted that Bill Murray basically plays the same character over and over again. He's like, he's cynical. His humor is like a running commentary, deadpan. He's rude. He's an asshole. He's like slightly creepy. See, I fall on the slightly creepy. I think that you think he's more than slightly
I'm
creepy.
I'm more on the low level sexual harassment, but
yeah, I'm like in the baby it's cold outside creep kind of vibes. And at the end of the day, I find him to be charming and hilarious. I think he's funny. I thought his transformation was funny. And all of his really great lines that he says under his breath, I didn't catch at all when I was a kid. But now I caught all of them and I think that they're great. You know, and basically the trio of his cameraman and his producer are saying, why are you so bummed about, like, you know, having to cover this in Punxsutawney? Everybody loves Groundhog Day. And to which Bill Murray responds, like, well, people love blood sausage. People are morons. That could come across as him being a dick, but it just, to me, comes across as him being hilariously clever. I love him.
So Bill Murray playing Bill Murray at the beginning of this is, like, the worst version of Bill Murray. He's extra cynical. He's extra egomaniac. He's... yes, definitely a little harassy with his colleagues. He asks his producer for a pelvic massage as she's dropping him off at the hotel. Yeah, it's just stuff like that where it's like, is that your version of witty? Because that's just kind of icky. But, you know, it was a different time. It was a different Bill Murray. Who knows? So my take on this is he's going for extra awful Bill Murray at the beginning of this. And then because he's pretty quickly realizes he's caught in a loop, he starts going through all of the stages of grief that you probably would actually go through if you were caught in a time loop like this. He has a phase of denial, a phase of anger, his bargaining, depression, and then ultimately acceptance. By the time you get to the acceptance Bill Murray, he is a much different, nicer person and much more easy to stomach as a viewer. From my point of view, this, in some ways, in my mind, was the redemption of Bill Murray, not the redemption of Phil the Weatherman. So I totally went into this thinking, like, all right, is Bill Murray going to come out being a better Bill Murray? Than
and did he? Because I think he did.
By the end of it, he's still a little surly and a little, I don't know. He always plays Bill Murray. I can't detach him from his actual human form outside of the movies or every other role he's played. But yeah, he's definitely the most likable version of Bill Murray by the end of this movie.
Yeah, I like the way you said it, that it's all the stages of grief, because that's exactly what it is. As he's realizing and then goes through all of the endless loop, it's basically a series of mini montages and sequences. It's like his fuck it, there's no consequences phase. It's like his depression phase, where he's just eating an entire table's full of crappy diner food.
I didn't even take that as the depression phase. For me, that would be like the best part. There's no consequences. I will eat all of this coffee cake and then have a donut and then probably throw up, like Booten Rally, back down, eat rally. The rest of the food on that table.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorite sequences, because like, I love when he's stuffing his face. He doesn't give a shit about his cholesterol. And then he starts realizing that he wants to learn how to play the piano. He does get philosophical about Groundhog Day and the loops and like what it means to have more winter time. I like it.
His character at the beginning, so he starts in the weather station before they go to Punxsutawney and start covering Groundhog Day as part of the weather report for the morning news. He's so eager to get out of this, what he considers a small town station. I don't think the local news in Pittsburgh is as small potatoes as he's making it out to be, but yeah, like he wants to be the Willard Scott of, and he's just looking ahead, like, get me out of here. I don't want to be here. And part of his evolution at the end of the movie, he is appreciating being where he is at the exact moment that he's there. That's part of the, like, stop racing ahead, disregarding where you are right now. And I think that's a really good lesson he learns in this. And I like him better, where it's like, yeah, pump the brakes, man. You're here with the people you like, and you're eating the stuff you want and having a drink and playing the piano and, like, bettering yourself and helping people and, like, living in the moment. That's great. What a good lesson for him. So
I liked his evolution too, but I also really enjoyed his fuck it phases. And I think Bill Murray plays somebody losing his mind in a very special way. That's also
a very
funny
Bill Murray insanity.
Right? Like, he's just very even keeled about it. His deadpan humor does go over the head of kids. Like, they don't get all the lines and all the humor. And some of it still doesn't land because it is kind of low-level creep vibes, especially towards women. There's so many mini montages in here. So I'll just share my favorite of all the stages of grief. I guess it's the depression, the bargaining one or depression one, where he does get really philosophical. So it's funny that you mentioned that originally the script was conceived as something darker and more philosophical. But at some point, the Bill Murray character starts to confess to Rita, the Andy McDowell character, about what's happening to him, but he doesn't sound like a lunatic about it. He starts to actually predict what's about to happen. So he says, in 5 seconds the waiter is going to drop a tray, or in 10 seconds this guy is going to say this, and then this is going to happen. And at first Andy McDowell thinks he's crazy, but then clearly everything is coming through. He's just predicting everything. And then he goes into this whole theory about how he's a god and that he's a god because he could do these things. And maybe, quote, air quote, capital letter, the god is only a god because he's been around the longest. And I know that sounds ludicrous to be in a comedy, but as I was like listening to his screed, I was thinking, you know, his theory makes more sense than it should for a comedy.
That's where I think the writing here really balances that line nicely, because if it was just a philosophy movie, you'd have lines like that, but it would also be really boring and like weighed down. But you have all this crazy comedy going on, and then he comes out with a line like that, and it ties in perfectly with his character is a total egomaniac. And for him to say, I am a god, you have the level of, oh, Phil's just a friggin' egomaniac. But he unpacks it in a way that you go, actually, meaning a life going on here. Sure, hear about it. Like,
and
it works. And it shouldn't work, but it does work. So that's another area where I think adding the comedy to this movie really rounded it out in a way. I was talking about this with my husband last night, and he said, they're missing a montage where he just snaps and goes on a killing spree, or where he like tries cannibalism for once because he's going to wake up the next morning and everyone's restored. And initially I was like, ick, but then I was reading about the way they were balancing out the scripts between the philosophy and the darkness and the comedy. And there definitely was a decision made. He's not going to go on a killing spree. There's one day where he's running away from everyone, or he punches Ned in the face, and he's, you know, but they don't take it any further than that. They're not going really, really dark with it, because they did think of it and they thought, no, we absolutely are not exploring that thought line.
He does inadvertently kill the groundhog when he goes insane and like the car drives over a cliff. I mean, the groundhog is with them. Both my kids are like, but does the groundhog die? But yeah, it doesn't go that far.
Not until the next day.
But as he has this whole philosophy of what makes up a god, there's also things like the waitress trying to take their order. So you have these little dots of humor in there that soften the landing of him confessing that he's some sort of god.
Yeah, no, it's a very mundane background for a completely absurd thing that he's announcing to his boss.
Right, essentially. But I was curious, because I know you love your cleaning montages. So I was just curious, is there a montage that was your favorite or least favorite in his stages of grief here?
I mean, I think the car chases are always funny. So there's one car chase where he's driving drunk with the guys from the bar down the train track, and the cops are chasing. Like, you know, it's a fun. It's a car chase. And the other very famous Don't Drive Angry one where he kidnaps the groundhog and they drive off a cliff and it very dramatically catches on fire at the bottom just to
emphasize the point.
Like hammer it home. He's definitely dead. And then he wakes up immediately. Those are funny. But then in terms of what satisfies my, you know, I love my makeover and cleaning montages, is going to be the end, starting with he's decided that he's going to try to help the members of the community and he's improving himself. So you see him catch the boy who falls out of a tree. It's like, oh, that's nice of him. But he puts him down and just yells, you never say thank you at the kid.
I know, that was
the kid
funny.
Runs off and doesn't say thank you. Yeah. And then he's just like, see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
It starts there, but then it just shows him, you know, he's like helping ladies with a flat tire and he's doing all these good things. And he's reached the point where he's his best self. This is finally going to be the day that does it and he could break the loop. I was reading, they took out a scene, I don't even know if they filmed it or if it was just in the script and they realized it didn't fit, but there was supposed to be another moment in the depression sequence where he realizes he's read every single book in the town.
Oh no.
And they cut that. And there was another scene that got cut where I guess it was a montage of him seeing how far he could make it out of the town in one day before getting turned around and then waking up back in the town again. They cut that too. Cause I was reading, they really didn't want people thinking too hard about how the rules of this worked.
Yeah.
And then some studio exec had given them a note at one point that they wanted an explanation of why he was stuck in the loop. So there was some scene written where an ex-girlfriend cursed him with like a voodoo doll or something. Oh, and they had a reason why he was stuck in the loop. But like, it's so much funnier that it's random and unexplained.
Yeah.
So I'm glad they decided to cut all of that stuff. You know, like we don't need to see him running out of books. We don't need to see him trying to run out of town. So yeah, good the way they did it.
Yeah.
Well, there's other characters playing off of Phil. They don't realize they're in the loop, but we see them every day, starting with his producer, Rita, played by Andie MacDowell. Jess, what did you think of Andie MacDowell as Rita?
Well, funny you should ask me that question. So listeners, I did have to give Amanda a warning. And if you've listened to previous episodes, you know that Amanda has this thing against certain actors that are inexplicable. One of those actors being Adam Driver.
Oh God, he's annoying.
Yeah, but you know, Andie MacDowell is my Adam Driver. I just can't stand her.
Oh, amazing.
I can't stand her in anything. I think she ruins movies. I feel bad beating up on an actress because we really like to highlight really good female performances and really well-written female characters and screenwriters, but good God, she is not one of them. She's like a bump on a log.
Yeah.
There are so many things I could say about how poorly I think she goes toe-to-toe with Bill Murray in this. All of her lines, yeah. And I think this extends beyond this movie. It's as if someone AI dubbed over what a female lead voice should be, and that's how she delivers her lines. They just all fall flat to me. I think her performance is so poor that, like, it makes the love story completely nonsensical. Like, what does he see in her? She's, like, the worst. She's so boring, Amanda.
I just love that somebody has made you realize what the Adam Driver level is for me, and now you have your own Adam Driver list.
Yeah, but Adam Driver's a good actor, and I think you're crazy. But anyway, and Annie McDowell, like, she was in Four Weddings and a Funeral, which is another good movie, and I think she ruins it. Like, she's just a movie ruiner.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you here. Actually, I should just let you keep ranting. This is pretty funny. What else about Annie McDowell? Actually, you and I made the same note on this. One thing I absolutely could not stand is her hideous vest that she's wearing.
It's very early 90s.
When she's trying to get dressed up in Punxsutawney, she is wearing like a long sleeve shirt with like a frilly collar, and then she has like a silk vest over it and like frumpy black pants. Yes, maybe that's like I'm wearing my office wear that I had with me to a party tonight because that's all I had packed, but it's hideous looking. Like, you're not looking like a girl boss in that. You look like you are an extra from the Brady Bunch who just... I can't even come up with a good metaphor for how awful this outfit is. So.
We've made fun of mock turtlenecks from the Silence of the Lambs episode, and I think the vest is worse. I find the vest less offensive than I find Andy McDowell in this movie. I mean, if the vest started talking, it would probably perform the lines better. I mean, oh my God. So Bill Murray is very funny, and I don't know how much he ad-libbed this. And you expect, like we reviewed in Ghostbusters, we really like Sigourney Weaver's character, Dana. She doesn't take his creepy crap. She goes toe-to-toe.
Yeah, she punches back. She's good.
She punches back. She kind of goes with the humor. I mean, Sigourney Weaver's a great actress. And even, I know we haven't reviewed this, but I think about podcast favorite Karen Allen, who starred opposite Bill Murray in Scrooged. And Karen Allen was like the perfect foil for him. She plays the straight man and doesn't have many funny lines herself, but still does so well with Bill Murray. They have such great chemistry on screen. But Andy McDowell brings absolutely nothing to this at all. Like,
No, I actually agree with you here. There's montages of her slapping Bill Murray, and I feel nothing. Like, I get really excited when Karen Allen punches Harrison Ford in the face. Yeah, like, that's a just a very satisfying scene. But watching Rita punch Phil in the face and just over and over again, it's just like, she doesn't really seem like she cares. I don't know. She's very milquetoast. There's nothing she does or says that's particularly exciting or intriguing. And I can't find her particularly attractive while she's walking around in that vest. That vest has got to go. It's awful.
It's got to go. Awful. It's worse than the mock turtleneck.
Like, but how is she the love interest?
But how is she the love interest? Because you don't really understand what he sees in her because her character falls flat so much. I guess she's a pretty face, but there's really nothing to it. She doesn't say smart things. She doesn't go toe-to-toe. And so it sort of kills the romantic elements that are built into the script. And even my kids, who like, they don't like the romance stuff in any movie, but they even both commented, like, they didn't like the kissing parts. They didn't like the romance courting parts because I think partly because they didn't understand that there's any chemistry whatsoever between these two characters. It just didn't work. Yeah. And it's her fault.
The moment that I think sums up her character is when Phil is actually telling her, oh, I've been in this loop and I know everyone so well, including you, and here's your details. And he goes, you're a sucker for French poetry and rhinestones. And I'm just like, kill me. Like, come on. That's so boring.
So boring.
So boring. Rhinestones. Her character does not have anything sparkly about her at all. Like, no, she's wearing Land's End catalog shit.
There is one funny scene, but I think it's almost by accident that she's funny in it, where Bill Murray asked her to describe her perfect man. And this is part of this is like earlier on in the sequences where Bill Murray's just trying to manipulate people. So he spends one day finding things out about people so he could use that to maybe get in their pants the next day. So he asks Andy McDowell what her ideal man is. And so she just launches into like the longest list of attributes you've ever heard in your life. And they're all stereotypical. She's like, I want a strong man, but doesn't look at his body. I want a smart man who's humble, you know, but she goes on and on. And it goes on long enough that it makes it funny. And at some point it goes on so long, Bill Murray just looks at her and goes, we're talking about a man, right? And I thought that was such a funny, it was so funny. And I don't think it's meant to be like, oh, you must be talking about a woman, but it was just no. Like, it was more just like, you're talking about a human being, right? Like, who could have all these things? So that was like the only funny part.
Somebody else wrote that and she's just reading the lines, but a funnier actress could have delivered that, and someone else could have gone toe-to-toe with Bill Murray, and she's absolutely not the right actress for it.
Yeah. We listed off two of his other co-stars that are great.
I just like that you have an Adam Driver list now.
Oh, I do. Which it has one person on it, and that person's name is Andy McDowell.
Andy McDowell list.
She's number 1 through 10 on the list. What do you see in her, Phil?
Then rounding out the trio from the local news channel, we have Larry, who is their camera guy, played by Chris Elliott.
I love
Chris Elliott. He is very underused here. He is such a funny actor. And they're making him just lurk in the background, occasionally say something weird or creepy, but like not Bill Murray creepy, just, you know, he's trying too hard creepy. He did have my favorite line in this viewing. Like, I laughed harder at Chris Elliott than anything else in the movie. It's that scene after Phil has kidnapped the groundhog and they go racing through in the pickup truck and they're about to drive off the cliff. And Rita is driving along with Larry behind them. And Rita goes, why would anybody kidnap a groundhog? And Larry just turns to her and goes, I could think of a few reasons. And the way he delivers that, I just started laughing like, ew, oh, God. Oh, Larry, like, ew, don't go there. But like the look on his face, just, I was dying laughing when he said that. I forgot he said that. That was his best line. I think it was like the funniest delivery in the whole movie.
Yeah, I actually couldn't get into Schitt's Creek, which is a whole other thing. But his character in Schitt's Creek is really funny. So he's a funny actor. Yeah. He's been in a million things. But I feel like it's sort of a nothing in this movie. They don't really give him a lot to do. It's really Bill Murray's show.
It is. Yeah, they're encouraging him to be the dopey sidekick who I bet he only has like 12 lines in this whole movie.
There's some funny bits, like when he's at the very end for like the last day, when he's hitting on some woman and he's being so boring and weird, and he's trying to explain to her that there's more to being a cameraman than meets the eye. And then they decide to go to the party and he's like, oh, let me just leave the tip. And he leaves a big tip. And then as soon as the woman walks away, he like takes back his big tip.
They let him do stuff like that. Funny.
Yeah, so like he has those.
And he tries to join the bachelor auction at the end of the movie, and nobody will bid on him, and he's just standing there awkwardly. Like, that's kind of funny, but they're not letting him go fully unleashed. If you want to see good Chris Elliott, go see There's Something About Mary. He is unhinged in that movie, and it's hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, you could argue they probably should have had more comedic support for Bill Murray, especially because he was getting fucking nothing from Andy McDowell. So,
yeah. You know. We reviewed Die Hard a few weeks ago for the holidays. Mm-hmm. And we had revealed that Bruce Willis, because of his shooting schedule, had actually encouraged the writers and directors to give the other characters a little bit more to do.
That's right.
I think that was needed here for Larry, or, well, they could have given Andy McDowell a ton more to do, and it just would have pissed Jess off more. But
you just have to replace her with like literally anyone. I don't even know if they need. I don't even know if they need to be an actress. Just like anyone.
I'm loving how much you hate her. This is great.
I know. I really do. Just if we ever review Four Weddings and a Funeral, I will.
I don't think we will. I don't feel like.
Well, here's my review. Yeah, this will be a big chunk of it, is how much I don't like Andy McDowell.
Jess hates Andy McDowell.
Oh, my God.
All right, we reviewed it.
Done.
Another character who is in this, who has minimal lines, minimal appearance, but whoa, what an impact, is Ned Ryerson, played by Stephen Tobolowsky. The second he walked onto the screen, before he even talked, my brain just went, Ned Ryerson, like,
he's so memorable. Like, just, yeah,
he's so obnoxiously memorable. He's here playing that perfectly annoying guy with the punchable face, and he's knocking it out of the park.
He nails it.
So annoying as Phil's former high school classmate, I guess. And he's an insurance salesman, and he's just relentless. Won't take no for an answer, following him down the street, like, I'm going where you're going. And he's the guy who Phil finally punches out when we're in the moment of despair and depression versions. Like, just get rid of Ned Ryerson. Oh, my God.
Oh, my
God. He's so funny.
Yeah, like, he does not have a lot of screen time, but it's memorable. There's super fun lines. When he first meets, like, on the first day when he meets Bill Murray, and he's like, I sell insurance. And Bill Murray's like, that's a shocker. I mean, there's just such great, funny chemistry they have. And this is actually one of my favorite montages in some ways, because they go back to Ned Ryerson throughout the movie. And sometimes Bill Murray punches him. He tries to avoid him. But one of my favorites is, like, to get rid of him, Bill Murray was like, Ned? And he just wraps his arms around Ned, but doesn't let go. And gives him, like, a super awkward long hug. And he's like, I've missed you so much. Ned's character, like, gets out weirded by Bill Murray being weird. And I love that. That's, like, my favorite.
Apparently Bill Murray ad-libbed, what was the line, that, like, hey, are you going anywhere right now? Or there's some line like, hey, do you want to go, like, hook up with me somewhere, insinuated. But Bill Murray just threw that in.
Yeah, it's very funny. I mean, so that whole thing, and my kids kind of got a kick out of Ned too. He's still memorable, I think.
Yeah. And kudos to Stephen Tobolowsky, because this was my first time seeing him, I think, in any movie, but he frequently is, like, the dorky neighbor, the dorky annoying coworker. Mm-hmm. But if you've ever seen Mississippi Burning, he plays head Klansman and is just friggin' terrifying. Like, he has a different switch he can flip and be so scary. Kind of reminds me of in Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, the Nazi who's got the coat hanger.
Oh my gosh.
What's that guy's
Nazi
name? I'm blanking on it. Yeah, that Tobolowsky can flip the switch and do that if he wants to. So, like, him being over enthusiastic dork in this movie is great.
Yeah, it's a good cover for being a psychopath, I guess.
In the town where they filmed all of these takes of Ned Ryerson, bing, that town has put up a plaque right on that street corner, and it's called Ned's Corner now.
Do they sell insurance from that corner? Because that'd be funny.
There's a big puddle permanently there. No.
Permanently there. Yeah, so that gag still lands. It's still funny. It's still funny for kids, too. It's a good one.
And there's just enough of it, because if you had to spend the whole day in a Ned Ryerson loop, oh my God.
Oh my God. Well, I think there are some things that this movie gets really right. Like, there are some bits like this that are just go on for just long enough, and they come back to it just enough times to make it funny, but not to make it grating. There are some other things, like, I don't love the suicide sequences. I feel like that was not needed. It's a little over the line, and I think if you made this movie today, you would have not done that and made light of suicide.
I don't think they're making light of suicide, but I think that is one of the phases. I mean, maybe they didn't have to show what he was doing, but I feel like they needed to show him in the morgue, and they needed to show that he was going through a phase where he was just so distraught he was trying to end
the depression phase. Yeah. Some of it's funny.
I think we need that, but they could have done it differently. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's all right. I don't mean to be clutching my pearls about it, but it's just something that feels like in 2024 sensibilities, they probably would have done it a little differently. I mean, some of it's really funny. Like, you know, he, like, stumbles into the lobby, grabs the biggest toaster oven that's ever been made ever, and drops it in the tub, and like, the whole shirt.
Oh, and I like Mrs. Lancaster just sees him do it and is like, do you want some toast? As he walks away, and then you just see the lights flicker and go out. That one was funny. Like, I liked the execution on that, but the ones where he's jumping off the building or he's stepping into traffic.
I didn't need that. To me, those bits, I got the point with the toaster. I didn't need to keep seeing him commit suicide. But yeah, getting back to the Ned Ryerson, that one, like, the bit is just long enough, and most of the bits are well-timed.
Yeah. I mean, I'll fix your problem for you. They could have had that scene just they show Rita removing the sheet from his face when he's in the morgue, and they could have just said he stepped in front of a truck or he fell off a building or, you know, and just done a whole sequence of her pulling the sheet down and saying what he did without actually showing him doing it. But the toaster was worth it. Keep the toaster.
Keep the toaster. It was funny. In terms of getting out of the loop, I asked my kids, what do you think he needs to do to make this end? Or does it end? I was just trying to lighten the mood after the suicide sequences. And like, my son was just like, he needs to destroy the clocks. Like, my son went full violence and was like, let's destroy all the clocks. And this is, I think, the difference between a 7 and 12 year old. So that was my son. And my daughter's like, I think he needs to learn the joy of Groundhog Day. And I'm like, excellent. You get an A.
Closer. Yeah.
A little closer.
You could have written this.
Yeah.
Those are really all the characters we want to talk about in this movie. Although I'll call out a few quick just appearances. I absolutely need to call out. There's all these people at the end of the movie who come up to Phil and thank him for, you know, you did this for us, you did that for us. But there's this young couple who just got married, and apparently Phil provides marriage counseling now. So he talked them into getting married. Great. But the young groom is a very unrecognizable Michael Shannon, who is so scary in everything now. And it's weird to see him playing like a newlywed in Groundhog's Day. So keep an eye out for him. Have you seen The Shape of Water?
No, I haven't.
The fish. Oh, okay. Like, he just plays dark characters. He's always like boss who's not just gonna like harass you, he's gonna murder you secretly. Like, he's just got this evil look about him and everything he's in lately. And he's completely unhinged. So yeah, it's just like, oh, thank you for helping my marriage. It's just like, oh my God, Michael Shannon.
Yeah.
By the time we get to that final scene, Phil has acquired a number of talents, and some of them are done to impress Rita, but some of them are just done for his own sake. So he picks up, he's got piano lessons, and he seems to be good at both jazz and classical by the end of this. He somewhere takes ice sculpting lessons with a chainsaw, and that just seems to be a whim. Shows up in one scene. That. He learns French and then 19th century French poetry. There must be a book somewhere in the town. That's purely to impress the woman who loves French poetry and rhinestones.
Oh my God. Most boring woman on the planet. Not worth it, Phil.
Yeah, actually. Well, no. He hits and hooks up with Nancy. Like, there's other people in the town. Yeah. He doesn't have to just stick to Rita. But, you know.
It's true. He shouldn't. He should branch out.
Phil also learns a bunch of medical procedures. We get to see him do the Heimlich maneuver. He does CPR, although that doesn't really work. It's referenced he realigns someone's spine. Like, okay.
Yeah.
Off chiropractor. Yeah. Why not? And then, by the final scene of him doing his Groundhog's Day broadcast is apparently so eloquent that the entire reception area of the groundhog ceremony has gathered around to listen to his wise words, and people are applauding and tearing up a little bit, just so moved by his description of the groundhog. Public speaking, maybe there's a Toastmasters somewhere in this town.
Maybe.
Did you have a favorite skill, or do you have a skill you wish you'd learned?
I like that he picks it up from here and there. I like that it was kind of subtle. They don't really focus on it too much unless it's funny. It all sort of collected together. And I like that some of them are off camera too. So when you get to the final reveal, you still have some sort of surprise element. When you go to the Groundhog Day party, it's like when people are thanking him, there's like new things popping up. So it sort of emphasizes the point.
Yeah. Fun reveals as people come up and say, hey, thank you for doing this crazy thing that we didn't see him do on camera. And wonderful. So one thing that came out of this film that is ultimately a bad thing, but this was filmed during Bill Murray's divorce. And he, up until this point, was very good friends with Harold Ramey, the director and writer, because they are both Ghostbusters.
Former Ghostbusters, yeah.
But apparently they just drove each other crazy. Bill Murray wanted this film to be darker and more philosophical. Like, he was trying to lean into drama a little bit more. And Ramey was like, no, this, you know, it's a comedy and this works much better as a comedy, and definitely towed the line. But I mean, we were talking before we started recording, there's reports of Harold Ramey had Bill Murray by the throat during this, a fight that went on set. And they stopped speaking to each other after this for years, until right before Harold Ramey died. And I guess Bill Murray patched it up. But yeah, that's such a huge bummer that they both just got on each other's nerves and broke off the friendship there. I do think it's funny, though, by the time they got to the scene where they're making a snowman and the kids show up to throw snowballs at him, Harold Ramey told those kids to throw the snowballs as hard as they could at Bill Murray.
And the kids, he's like, get that asshole.
And then Bill Murray threw that. Yeah. And then Bill Murray was pegging them as hard as he could. It was just like, oh my God, you've made him fight with children. Like, jeez.
Yeah.
I don't know. None of this is a good thing, but just calling out that there was a lot of tension on this set. I'm glad they finally patched it up before we lost Harold Ramey.
Yeah, that's sad. Yeah,
bummer.
I feel like for good things is that, to me, this movie is peak Bill Murray's humor. I mean, this is the peak. You see it in other movies he's in, but I think this is his funniest role. I really do. I also just generally think the staying power of, let's say, people our age or this generation, where Groundhog Day can now mean something else in terms of describing being in a loop, is also, it's sort of similar to Ferris Bueller or to, you know, this one time at band camp or something. That's just, it's sort of generational in terms of where people know where that comes from. But this is like an entire definitional phrase versus just a movie reference. So I think that that's kind of good staying power for a movie. But what about you?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. We said it earlier, but this is a movie that has the movement from the worst case Bill Murray to the best case Bill Murray for me. And if it had gone the other way, I would have hated this movie. But like, ending up with your best possible Bill Murray is a good, happy ending, I think, for the movie. It's definitely a funny movie, but it also has some very touching moments. Like, there's that whole montage sequence with him trying to help the homeless man and prevent his death, and like, that actually is really poignant. And you know, I forgot that was in there, so it's just like, ha 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 ha.
I did too.
Like, oh man, like, the it just grounds this movie in a way that it didn't really have the same kind of stakes when it was just Bill Murray doing nonsense and nothing ever matters. But then when you realize, oh, somebody dies this day that he's living over and over again, and watching him try to fix that, like, that really hit me because I forgot it was in there.
Right. And it probably just generally hits adults more than it would hit kids. So, you know, you might not have hit you as a kid watching it. It just doesn't. Those things kind of don't when you're younger.
Yeah. But it's very touching because he does very noticeably ignore the homeless man in the first few times he lives this day. And he's trying to do CPR on him by the end of it. So this movie balances the comedy, and its ultimate message is very philosophical. And, you know, live in the moment and appreciate where you are and what you have. It's a feel-good movie, but with Bill Murray in it. So you don't realize it's a feel-good movie.
Yeah. I mean... Not to rain on your parade, but I did think of what would be like the worst loop to be in. And I think the worst loop would be is that you're as funny as Bill Murray and you have to like wait through Andie MacDowell doing her version of those lines over and over again. And that would just be the fucking worst. That would be the worst.
So you're saying shooting Groundhog's Day was Bill Murray's Groundhog's Day.
Yeah, essentially. And having to like listen to Andie MacDowell try to deliver lines that were like halfway coherent. I think that would be the worst loop.
Oh,
man, I'm just such an asshole. I hope I don't get hate mail for this one.
I don't think anyone could possibly send you hate mail over
That's
Andie
true.
MacDowell,
whereas like, I don't know, Adam don't Driver, know. Maybe, Amanda.
We've never officially reviewed any of his movies.
And we never will. I know. But
in our childhood, this is just a careless reference that gets thrown every so often. Like, is that person on the Adam Driver list?
Yeah, exactly. Like, might... Yes, she's the one.
Well, should we go to ratings?
Yeah, I think we are ready for ratings. So just to remind folks, so we rate from 1 to 10, 1 being garbage, 10 being Princess Bride. And we first rate for how it lives up to us as adults. And then we move on to an imagining of how it lives up to kids today. And then we kind of ultimately move on to whether it lives up or not. So for our adult rating, what do you think?
I'm going to actually, in the spirit of being in a loop and repeating yourself, I'm going to give this the same rating that I gave in our last episode of to Clue, and that was a 6.5.
What did you dock it points for?
I think this viewing, I hadn't seen this movie in a decade or two, whenever I last saw it at a library somewhere. I think I remembered it being all comedy, and that I was excited for like a very funny Bill Murray movie. And I think I was very icked out by his character in the beginning. So it's getting some points docked for me remembering this being like delightful and funny. And it's not a delightful kind of comedy until the end. It's you're slogging through with like a cynical egomaniac. I remembered the end of the movie being the vibe of the whole movie. And I think that's what I'm dinging it for here. Also, not enough Chris Elliott, and also Andy McDowell, as you said, is milquetoast, and I could have done without her.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. I'm going to go slightly higher for a 7, sort of docking it for the same reasons. I think if you had other supporting characters that were added to the texture of the humor, it would really be much higher. But it's 7 is still high because I still think Bill Murray is, I find him to be funny. The lines are still clever. So, and I enjoyed most of the sequences again. I thought it was really fun. Like the Ned Ryerson one too. I mean, that's just classic. So the classic ones are still classic. So yeah, I gave it a 7. So it's still pretty high for us. We've been high lately.
All right. We have been high lately. So the kid ranking, this is interesting because I'm sort of reacting to what your kids said during the movie and how they understood it or didn't understand it. But then also remembering being in the movie theater and seeing this and thinking it was hilarious and really enjoying it as a kid myself. Yeah.
For kids, I'd say, so my son, who's 7, didn't get the concept, as we had mentioned. My daughter did. I mean, I think as a concept, it still works. And there's enough slapstick in there for slightly younger kids. And yet the older kids or tweens can understand the philosophical stuff too. They can understand the transformations. So, I mean, in some ways it's not super dated. I'd say the super dated parts might be just some of Bill Murray's humor goes over their heads. But other than that, there's not a ton of references for 80s and 90s.
I mean, that god-awful vest she's wearing. Ugh. That's dated. Yeah. That's and dated.
They really did it. I mean, this is nothing necessarily to do with kids, but I think this is also why, you know, you and I noting Andy McDowell and not liking her, really hating on her, but like the romance part of this does not land with kids.
I will say, mercifully, there really isn't any sex scenes.
Yeah.
And that the romantic scenes between the two of them, they're really that just would have been talking. Painful. They maybe kiss a few times.
My kids did note, they're like, there's a lot of kissing in this movie. Because there are some makeout scenes.
Well, because they're in a loop.
Right, because they're in a loop. But I think it's because they're probably like, who wants to kiss Andy McDowell? She's so annoying. But anyway, so that's what I'll say for kids.
I think I'm letting my nostalgia really bleed in here. I'm going, once again with the loop, I'm going 6.5. I'm not giving up my 0.5s.
I agree. It's a cool idea that still lands. I typically grade harsher for kids. So I am going to go a bit harsher here. I guess I'm going to go as low as a 5, only because I think some of the humor does go over their heads, but the concept is good. So I do think kids will like this movie. If they're old enough to understand the concept, they'll like it, but they're not going to have necessarily the same affection for it. So I went right in the middle, let's say a 5.
Well, I have our total score, but I don't want to
tell you
what it is. Because we establish that there's a line and it usually predicts if we say something lives up or not. And you're just going to have to re-record this a third time to know what it is in advance.
So listeners, it's not just the rating. So now we go through and deem individually whether we think this movie lives up. We both have to agree for as a podcast to say this lives up. And then you'll tell the listeners what our total score is, although they could probably do math faster than me. So does it live up? So I would argue it does. I know we were like a little harsh. Obviously, we're like super harsh at Andy McDowell and all that. But there's nothing that's cringy. There's nothing that's too time capsule-y. I think it's still funny. It's still a good concept. It has staying power. So I think it lives up.
All right. So everything except for Andy McDowell lives up.
But
for
she
Jess.
Didn't even like, she wasn't even good to start with. So I feel like, what does it matter?
We'll rephrase that. Even Andy McDowell couldn't sing this movie.
Even Andy McDowell couldn't sing this movie. But it could have been a lot better. This movie could be in like real cult classic territory.
Yeah, with a Karen anyone. Allen or a Sigourney Weaver or, yes.
Or literally anyone. Yeah.
I still enjoyed watching this, and I think it's a soft It Lives Up for Me, but it does live up for me. I would be willing to watch this again, not
I would
immediately.
Too.
I wouldn't watch this in a loop the way we did as kids. Like, rewind the VCR. All right, put the tape back on. Rewind it again.
I like the philosophical stuff. So that was something new, too, to appreciate as an adult. So I think that also enhances the experience. So yeah. It Lives Up. Congratulations.
It lives up. And you know what? It's right on that line. It had a total score of 25, and we said between 25 and 26 is exactly where we tend to
go. It could go either way. Yeah,
so you know, you're lucky I put those 0.5.
I am your half scores. So all right, well, listeners, this means that Groundhog Day, it officially lives up. Go see it. No worries about watching it with your kids. If you agree, disagree, don't yell at me too much about Andie MacDowell. We're at Live Up Pod on all the socials. So would love to know your thoughts, whether you think it lives up. Thanks for listening.
Hey, Jess, do you want to go record this for a third time?
Only three? Should we just keep going?
Let's record
all
it again.
Night. Oh, my God.
And again. Thanks for listening.